Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's call. All participants are currently in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one keys on your touch-tone phone. Please note today's conference will be recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn today's program over to Vice President of Media and Communications for First Focus on Children, Michelle Kale. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for making time for our conversation. As some of you may know, children of immigrants make up roughly one quarter of all kids in the U.S., and they're the fastest growing group of children in America. The vast majority of these children are U.S. citizens. The administration's public charge rule is going to disproportionately impact these children. Today, our expert panel is here to outline the direct and indirect threats that the rule poses to these children and to answer your questions. Each of our speakers will offer a five-minute or so analysis, and then we're going to open it up to your questions. Our speakers are Kristen Torres, who's Director of Child Welfare and Immigration for First Focus on Children. She's going to offer you a high-level overview of the way that the rule targets children and families. Sasha Pudelski, who's Advocacy Director for AASA, the School Superintendents Association. Sasha is going to be talking about how the parts of the rule that are not specifically directed at children will still affect them, such as Medicaid in schools and implications for housing and homelessness. And Dr. Chasty Anderson, who's Senior Policy Associate at Children's Defense Fund in Texas. And Dr. Anderson is going to offer us examples of the rule's impact that CDF Texas has encountered and expects to see more of. Kristen, why don't you go ahead and start, please?
Thank you, Michelle. As you know, yesterday the Trump administration finalized a rule that will expand the definition of a public charge. This expansion will allow consideration of an applicant's use of services such as Medicaid, SNAP, federal, state, and local cash assistance programs, and subsidized housing vouchers when they determine eligibility for individuals applying for admission to the U.S. or for the adjustment of status to lawful permanent resident. To make this determination, DHS will look at the totality of a person's circumstances, so this includes their age, health, assets, education, and their financial status. A person may be deemed a public charge if he or she has used one or more public benefit for more than 12 months in the aggregate within a 36-month period, and receipt of two benefits will count as 2 months. Some important changes to call out here in this final rule is that contrary to the proposed rule, Medicaid will not be considered for those under the age of 21 and for pregnant women through 60 days after giving birth. The Children's Health Insurance Program, Head Start, WIC, and Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program will also not be included in this list of services. There are some exemptions to the rule, and they can be found in Section 212 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, and those exemptions include refugee and asylum seekers, TPS holders, special immigrant juveniles, and the list is exhaustive in that list. Sorry about that. But in our opposition to this rule, First Focus, we continue to point to the fact that this rule will disproportionately affect children. As Michelle has mentioned, the population of children of immigrants is rapidly growing, and I would like to point to a few ways in which this rule will impact in children and families. The first and foremost, children are not exempt from the public charge determination. In the rule, DHS recognizes that children are not making decisions to apply for these benefits themselves, yet they do not make an exemption for those who fall under the head of household. Alarmingly, DHS even goes out of their way to make the argument that they do not fall under contractual law, and therefore a person does not have to have the capacity to understand the consequences of their actions. As we mentioned before, children are specifically exempt from Medicaid. However, other benefits such as TANF and SNAP will be used against children seeking an adjustment of status if they are not seeking a status that falls under the exemptions. Also clearly stated in the rule, DHS recognizes that this may deter some parents from applying for benefits for their children. The second point I would like to call out is that children are considered negative factors both for themselves and for the consideration of their parents in the totality of circumstances. The rule specifically says it will consider an age of less than 18 as a negative factor, as under 18 they are unable to be meaningfully employed. Household size will be viewed as negative unless the household members are contributing to the household income. Therefore, children who are unable to contribute are viewed as a negative factor in these considerations. The number of benefits received is also a negative factor, and we know that eligibility for services such as SNAP and Medicaid aren't often in silos, and eligible families may need assistance on multiple fronts. The third point I would like to make, this will result in millions due to not being exempt, the consideration of a negative factor. This will result in millions of kids losing access to health care, housing, and nutrition. On the healthcare front, while there are exclusions in Medicaid, it's likely that the parents of these children will choose to forego healthcare coverage to avoid negative immigration consequences. We also know that when parents don't have access to healthcare, their children are less likely to have access to healthcare. Housing. When parents lose housing, the children who live with them also lose their housing. In the rule, the administration notes that it expects increased rates of poverty and housing instability. Nutrition, the rule threatens the children's access to food at home and at school. Parents and children may disenroll from the SNAP program, again, to avoid public charge determination. But even if eligible children remain on the program, this means less food in the household. Kids enrolled in SNAP automatically receive free school meals, but once they forfeit the SNAP enrollment, they would not have that automatic follow-through and are unlikely to apply for school meals because of a multitude of reasons, including language barriers, lack of information, and fear out of not being included in this rule. The chilling effect, which we'll talk a little bit about later, has already been seen with regards to SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, as we've seen a 10% decline in participation just during the first half of 2018 by eligible families. Another point to make is that this rule disproportionately affects family-based immigration. It's a direct attempt to cut family-based immigration, which we know the administration has attempted to do multiple times. In 2016, approximately 68% of total persons who obtained legal permanent resident status were the immediate relatives of U.S. citizens or had a family-based sponsor. This rule would make it more difficult for families to stay together or reunify, as we know that families both in the U.S. and abroad will be forced to meet these new range of demands. The rule will have an enormous chilling effect for families seeking assistance. Parents will forego benefits who are covered by the rule for themselves and their children in order to avoid negative immigration outcomes. Parents and families will also consider giving up benefits that are not covered just out of a general fear, and the impact will extend beyond the intended targets. As I mentioned before, we've already seen this in several instances, including in the SNAP program. And finally, the point I'd like to make is the administration knowingly subjected these children to hardships multiple times throughout the rule. They acknowledge that the proposal will affect children and other vulnerable populations. Specifically, the rule states that disenrollment from public programs will result in declining child health, increased poverty and homelessness, reduced productivity, and educational attainment. And with that, I'll turn that over to Michelle.
Thanks very much, Kristen. Appreciate that. Sasha, can you please talk to us a bit about the indirect impacts of this rule?
Sure, absolutely. So AASA, as was mentioned, is the School Superintendents Association, and we're the professional organization of more than 13,000 educational leaders in the U.S. And our leaders, as well as our organization, submitted comments to DHS when the proposed reg came out, urging them not to move forward with this policy that we felt would really exacerbate the needs of our nation's youngest and most vulnerable students. And the reason why we've been so engaged is that, of course, schools have a legal requirement to accept and educate all students that come through our door, regardless of their or their family's immigration status. And, you know, our expectation is that federal laws and policies should be supportive of school districts in their efforts to educate students, not do what this regulation does, which is actually undermine those efforts. Specifically when it comes to the Medicaid program, while the final regulation does clarify that general and special education students that access school-based healthcare programs that are funded via Medicaid, those that access will not be held against a child who wishes to become a permanent resident. That wasn't actually the primary concern that we voiced initially in the regulation and that remains our concern today, because our concern is that districts need explicit consent from parents if they wish to bill Medicaid for healthcare services for children. And this consent has to be given on an annual basis. And we already know that since the proposed regulation was announced, parents have been proactively revoking consent for the district to bill for Medicaid services for their kids for fear that it could be held against the child or the family. And while school leaders and school nurses and other healthcare advocates have, you know, tried to explain to families that, it, you know, it's okay for the district to bill Medicaid for these services, of course, many parents and families are skeptical or just don't want to risk entangling any of their family members in the Medicaid system given the trajectory of Medicaid and immigration policy by this administration currently. And one thing to note is that Medicaid is actually the third largest funding stream for school districts, and many school health positions are funded via Medicaid. So when families refuse to consent to billing Medicaid, districts are still on the hook for providing services, for example, for students with disabilities who are immigrant children as well. But we won't be able to receive any reimbursement back from the federal government, which will then place a really intense financial strain on them and requiring districts to dip into local funds to cover these costs. And beyond that, districts, of course, often deliver healthcare services to low-income children in schools that qualify for Medicaid, like providing, you know, asthma or diabetes management or doing vaccinations. And if parents revoke consent for Medicaid as well for these services, then the district may no longer be able to provide these services and may even have to let go of the providers that do these services. And that's a really serious issue for us. And it's really alarming because as schools are reopening their doors and kids are coming back to school, this regulation will be in effect. And it's in my opinion that schools are totally unprepared for the potential uptick of kids who are going to no longer be participating in the Medicaid program, no longer wanting to, the parents who are going to no longer want to consent to the district billing for Medicaid services, and the huge financial impact this could have on districts. And then you couple that with the uptick in the number of children who are going to be coming to school hungry, the number of kids who are going to be coming to school without housing. This is just not well known to school leaders. And so districts are going to have to adjust their funding in real time, which is never ideal, to try and find ways to support these kids. And in some cases, like with children who become homeless, meet new obligations to them. For example, with homelessness, when a child becomes homeless, and under this regulation, as it was mentioned before, families that participate in Section 8 public housing would have that participation held against them. The district has an obligation to provide services to a child, like transportation services, so that they can continue to remain in their school. This is it can be a very costly, actually, requirement for districts. And we've never really fully funded, come close to funding the requirement under McKinney-Vento in federal statute. So currently districts, many of which struggle to maintain the services that they are trying to provide for the homeless population they have today, would be really under duress to now expand those services for a new population of students, those who are impacted by this regulation. And so I think this is not something that anyone has anticipated, and it's going to come at a cost where districts are having to choose between spending money on educational activities and services, which is, of course, their primary mission, or redirecting those dollars towards, in some cases, Medicaid-related expenses, the healthcare services for kids, whether that's dipping into local coffers to make sure that kids are vaccinated, to make sure that we have a school nurse for them, to make sure that we're providing special education services under IDEA, or with the case of homeless students, providing transportation or other services that homeless students are required to under McKinney-Vento. So I see this as really passing the buck in some cases by incentivizing families to clearly not use the social safety net. This regulation is actually placing the burden on school districts to make up the dollars that would be going towards these social safety programs, and having local school districts have to step up and bear the brunt of the financial burden in ensuring that kids are healthy enough to learn, kids are well fed enough to learn, kids have the kind of stability in their lives that they need through McKinney-Vento to be able to be educated. So it's really passing the buck to school districts and forcing, I think, a lot of them to take on a much greater role than they can in terms of the financial responsibility that they have to serving immigrant children. And, of course, we know our members are ready and willing to do whatever it takes, but it's just going to be very difficult. And, again, there's many districts, I think, that are not aware of the financial burden that they'll be under as a result of this regulation.
Great. Thanks so much, Sasha. Chasey, can you talk with us a bit about what's going on in Texas and what CDF has seen there?
Yes, absolutely. Hi, everybody. My name is Chasey Anderson. I'm with the Children's Defense Fund of Texas. And I had a few comments I wanted to make and then can talk a little bit about some more anecdotal evidence that we've seen here locally. I wanted to emphasize that this rule was published in spite of overwhelming public opposition. There were 266,000 public comments, which was a new record. And DHS acknowledged when they published the final rule that the vast majority of those comments were in opposition. And I also want to emphasize that this regulation is the administration's attempt to make an end run around Congress. Regulations are supposed to enforce congressional intent, and in this case, this regulation runs counter to not just recent congressional intent, but also decades of congressional intent to make sure that immigrant families do have access to these public benefit programs. This regulation does not even try to address any known policy issue or problem. It is just a deliberate attack designed to confuse, scare, and isolate immigrant communities. It's not so much a punishment for using a few select public benefits, it's a punishment on families with low income, and it's designed explicitly to keep poor families out of the United States. One of the ways in which that happens is that while a lot of the focus has been on the public benefits that families will be punished or that applicants would be punished for using, there's also other elements of the public benefit, the public charge regulation. There's a wealth test in it, so that a family, even if they drop every public benefit program that they had enrolled in or been eligible for, if they do that and then make the application, but if their family income is below 125% of the federal poverty level, that still counts as a hard strike against their application. It's just fairly bald-faced exclusionary tactic to exclude families who live below 125% of the federal poverty level. I think it's also to note when we're talking about the public charge rule that this is not a rule that exists in isolation. This is part of a greater effort, something that advocates are beginning to call the invisible wall, because it's not just public charge and it's not just horrible conditions at the border and it's not just ICE raids in workplaces, but there's a host of other proposed regulations that are coming out from a variety of agencies from the administration. So there's this public charge regulation that's coming out of DHS. There's a proposed rule on deportability that's coming out of DOJ. There's a rule coming out at HUD that is exclusionary to families that have any undocumented members being able to access subsidized housing. And there was recently another proposed regulation from the Food and Drug Administration that would make it harder for immigrant families to access SNAP. So when you look at this regulation, it's important that we see it in the context of a greater, more coordinated attack, an effort to isolate immigrant communities and cause them to withdraw from society, essentially. So one of the things that the other speakers mentioned is that this is not just going to have an impact on the people who apply for benefits, who apply for a green card, either from within or without the United States, this is also having a huge impact on what we're calling the chilling effect among immigrant communities more broadly. So people who don't know precisely whether, you know, they will be affected by this, but they are withdrawing and they don't understand that it's just the applicants whose benefit use would be interrogated in an application for a green card. And so what we're seeing is huge numbers of families that are withdrawing their children, even and especially their citizen children, who are eligible for these programs from Medicaid, from SNAP, from CHIP, from programs that aren't even covered by the public charge regulation. And this started happening over a year ago, when the proposed regulation was first published. For example, there's a group called ECHOS in Houston, that's spelled E-C-H-O-S. And when the proposed regulation was published last year, they saw renewals for children's Medicaid down 28%. They saw renewals for food stamps for SNAP that were down by 33%. But it's really important to note, and they noted this as well, that that 33% reduction at SNAP, for SNAP benefits did not correlate to a reduction in need. In fact, the opposite. They also run a food bank, and they saw a 300% increase in families' use of their food bank at the same time that they saw the 30% reduction in enrollment for SNAP. I know a woman here, I work with her pretty closely, an organization called VELA, V-E-L-A, like candle in Spanish. And she was telling me about a family, this organization helps families who are of mixed status, where they typically have citizen children, but are either undocumented or not legal permanent residents. The parents are not legal permanent residents themselves. And they help them navigate the Medicaid program for children for their children who have disabilities. But increasingly, they're seeing, and they deal very closely with these families. They have long-standing relationships with them. And increasingly, they're seeing families who are not willing to enroll their children, even their children with extreme disabilities, in Medicaid because they're afraid of what it would mean for their ability to stay in the country. One mother recently had, I think, three or four children. The youngest one, I think it's the youngest, has autism. And she had refused to enroll any of her children in Medicaid. She herself was undocumented and was deported recently. And so Vela is working with the three children, with the oldest child, trying to help the oldest child now navigate the system and get her brother enrolled in Medicaid and get all of the children enrolled in Medicaid, while the mother is trying to help them from afar in Mexico. So we're seeing a huge chilling effect here in Texas, and I'm sure elsewhere in the country, I know elsewhere in the country as well, that is a direct response to public charge, but also just to the climate of fear that this administration is deliberately inculcating among immigrant communities. I think that's all I had to talk about for now. I'm open for questions whenever we do open questions.
Thanks very much. And Miranda, let's move to questions, please.
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star, then one keys on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, star, then one to ask a question. And we'll take our first question of the day from Daniel Trotta with Reuters. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you very much. You had, I believe it was Ms. Anderson, who was speaking about the impact of prior initiatives by the Trump administration that resulted in immigrants and immigrant families either disenrolling or not taking services. I'm wondering to what extent you may have noticed that again this time. Is it, maybe it's too soon because the rule doesn't take effect until October, but have you seen any evidence that this most recent announcement has led to any kind of drop-off in the past day or two? And then secondarily, I'd like to open it up to anyone on the panel. If you could talk about what you see as the potential budget implications. In the rule, they talk about they see $2.47 billion in savings from people not using, you know, in saved costs from people not using public assistance. But I think there's also, it's been, other experts have talked about how, well, yes, maybe that's an immediate savings, but it could lead to, say, people who denied preventive health care later on have more acute things and have to go to the emergency room or other sort of knock-on effects. I was wondering if anyone there can address what they really see as the budget implications for this.
Hey, thanks. This is Chase D. Anderson. I'll take the first part of that question. I think you're correct. It is a little too soon, you know, the day after the rule was published for me to be able to report on any numbers that are coming in or uptick in disenrollments. I think this is a really critical time for us as advocates, but also for the media to report out that families do have 60 days to decide, and that it's just critical that they do some research and get informed and not allow fear to stand in between. I mean, it makes sense that families are afraid right now. It's abundantly clear that it makes sense to be afraid. But the way to fight back is to keep your citizen children, especially enrolled in benefits, not withdraw your families from the services that you need in order to succeed and thrive. There's a website called protectingimmigrantfamilies.org. It's part of the PIF campaign, PIF, P-I-F, Protecting Immigrant Families. And there are a lot of resources on that site that are being updated as we speak, but available in English, Spanish, and a few other languages as well, that can answer questions for people, sort of like a walkthrough, like, will I be impacted by this? And for the media to be reporting out, you know, to letting people know that now is a good time to consult with a good immigration attorney, to look up resources, to get in touch with legal services organizations in their community, to find out precisely how they might be impacted, because I think a lot of people are going to find that they would not be impacted, and it's important that they not react from fear if they're not going to be impacted by the rule.
Okay, I just point out what...
This is Kristen.
This is Kristen with First Focus on Children, I'm sorry. While I don't have the exact numbers for some of these budget considerations, I do want to just point out that their own acknowledgement in the rule is that they do anticipate that the rule will lead to worse health outcomes, increased use of emergency rooms, increased prevalence of communicable diseases, increases in uncompensated care, and reduced productivity and educational attainment. And then I also would just point to, you know, there is an estimate that the rule would now drastically expand the population for which this test would be applied. So approximately 382,000 family-based immigrants within the U.S. per year. And then there was a report by the Migration Policy Institute that added an additional 550,000 persons living abroad would be subjected to this rule, and so I anticipate that would be a gigantic cost.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Chase D. One more time. I just wanted to add that a report just came out today, and I failed to mention it. I apologize. From Urban Wire, and they are reporting that about 1 in 7 adults in immigrant families report that they or a family member did not participate in one of the benefit programs in 2018. And among adults in low-income families earning less than 200% of the federal poverty level, the rate was actually 1 in 5, so over 20% of those immigrant families withdrew from benefits in the last year.
Thank you for that.
Sure. I don't know.
Thank you. And again, that's star one if you would like to ask a question today. And we'll go next to Michaela Ross with Bloomberg. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for taking the call. You had spoken a little bit about some of the broader impacts of different policies being put forward or proposals being put forward from the Trump administration on on immigrants and education. I'm wondering if you've heard anything on restricting actual access just to school in general for kids.
This is Tasha from AASA. I have not heard anything related to that. No, I have not heard about them attempts to block. I'm assuming you're talking about illegal immigrants, not legal immigrants, but access to education, no.
Okay.
I would just point out, too, that while I believe that was kind of a concern by many of the advocates as we were commenting on the proposed rule, the final rule does seem to take into account that Plyer v. Doe is kind of standing and that educational benefits are not going to consider those in this public charge rule.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we can move next to Ava Ayala with Dallas Morning News. Please go ahead.
And yes, I'm interested in learning a little bit more about how or when the districts could expect to start seeing this impact as far as, like, you know, the withdrawal of permission for Medicare or turn around and billing things for Medicaid and whatnot. And, you know, what the timeline typically looks for like that and how or when they might be able to see the impact that this is really going to play out for them?
I would say, this is Sasha, I would say it's going to be pretty immediate because those forms and that enrollment in free and reduced lunch too would also, a lot of parents, even though free and reduced lunch is not impacted by this regulation, we've already seen anecdotally, it's been reported widely that there's been parents who are proactively also, you know, withdrawing their children from that program. And so all of these kinds of the consents and for these kinds of federal programs are all done at the start of the school year. So when school opens, I would say within the first few weeks, districts will begin to realize that, you know, the numbers are not what they were last year, and alarm bells will go off in the heads of administrators who are going to try and obviously do outreach and figure out how to get the numbers up. But, you know, what we've seen at least within the last year is that given, again, the huge sense of fear and uncertainty by the community of immigrants that we serve, it's not likely that they'll be able to see the numbers that they were expecting for this year, which will directly impact school budgets within the first month of the school year.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder to our audience, that's star then one if you'd like to ask a question today. We'll pause just a moment to allow any further questions to queue. And we have no further questions in queue at this time. I'll return the floor back to our speakers. Oh, I do apologize. We have a follow-up from Ava Ayala. Please go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to circle back with Chesity, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Dr. Anderson. You've mentioned some anecdotal things out of Houston. Have you heard anything from any other parts of Texas as far as what they're seeing and some drops?
I did, yes. Foundation Communities, which is here in Austin, reported out, let me see if I can find it actually, that they had seen, I can't find the email right now, but they saw a similar reduction. I think they saw something like a 20 to 25% reduction in those coming in to seek enrollment assistance in a year-over-year analysis. And within that 20 to 30% reduction, they saw that 62% of that reduction was comprised of Latino families. And that was, again, that was a statistic that they were able to look at after the publication of the proposed regulation, not after the finalized regulation. So even the proposal had people running scared. I expect that we'll see some pretty sharp drops in enrollment.
Thank you. And again, that's star then one for any further questions. And we have another follow-up question from Daniel Trotta. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks. I thought I'd take advantage since someone else was in the queue. I know this is, you know, public health doesn't seem to be the expertise of anyone here, but can anyone comment on what you see as sort of the public health implications here, whether it's more has to do with long-term developmental issues or infectious diseases? I'm wondering what, you know, if anyone has any comment on that. Thank you.
Hey, this is Chasty. I'm obviously not a public health expert, but we work with public health experts, and there's a huge degree of concern over what we're going to see in terms of decreased immunization rates among children. Texas, of course, as you probably know, already has a very high maternal mortality rate, and we're concerned that we'll see, CHIP perinatal and pregnancy Medicaid are not included in the rule, as people withdraw anyway for fear of getting caught somehow, that we're going to see, as pregnant women go to the doctor less frequently, as they get poorer medical care in anticipation of a birth, that we'll see, higher maternal mortality rates, possibly higher infant mortality rates. Those are all concerns.
But do you see, for example, in the schools, that that's going to be a particular danger with, if kids aren't vaccinated?
This is Sasha. Yeah, I mean, certainly we're very concerned about the potential for, unvaccinated illnesses to emerge more than they already are as a result of this. I mean, I think what we know about kids' access to healthcare is that when parents have access to health insurance, children have more access to health insurance. They're more likely to go to the doctor regularly and get checkups. And so what we've seen whenever we have, we've seen the loss of 1 million kids on Medicaid and CHIP over the last year, primarily due to concerns about immigration. And what we know about that is that, districts have an obligation to meet the unmet healthcare needs of kids when it impacts their education. And so when a kid comes to school and they have a medical need that is not being resolved outside of school, oftentimes districts are the only place where that child can get access to healthcare services. So it falls on us to connect them with doctors, to have clinicians come in, to have our school nurses do more. And so it places a real burden on the district to address those healthcare needs that aren't being met. And we know from when kids are uninsured as well, parents oftentimes wait till Monday morning to get that kid into school so they can be seen by the school nurse. I mean, there's a fear or an inability in some cases to get them to the healthcare services they need when they're not in school. So again, our school-based providers are going to be really strained by the fact that we're going to have more kids and more families generally who are coming to school with unmet healthcare needs. And we'll have to be the ones to pick things up in light of the fact that they're not accessing the Medicaid system. And we'll have to pay for those services with our local education dollars because we're not going to be able to rely on Medicaid either to reimburse us for those services. So it's really a perfect storm. Well, we'll be doing a lot more as a result of this regulation to meet the unmet health care needs of kids.
And this is Kristen with First Focus. I would also, I think someone mentioned earlier, these issues aren't happening in silos. So as we saw, just last week, the students in Mississippi who are now impacted by the raids, the stress that these kids are under, whether or not their parents will be home once they return from school, these things are happening kind of all at once, and so there are several research projects ongoing on kind of how this toxic stress environment for kids is impacting both their physical and mental health. And so I think this just compounds what we are already seeing for children of immigrants, both documented and undocumented.
And Daniel, this is Michelle Kale from First Focus. I'd also just like to direct you to page 51270 of DHS's proposal. This is the proposed rule, and I'm not sure how it may have changed in the final rule, but that page, and I can send this to you, points itself acknowledges that the rule will create worse health outcomes, including increased prevalence of obesity and malnutrition, increased prevalence of communicable diseases, including among members of the U.S. citizen population who are not vaccinated, increases in uncompensated care, and, you know, increased emergent care as a primary method of health care because of delayed treatment. So that's by the administration's own admission that there will be a public health crisis that results from this.
Yes, please. If you could send that to me, that would be helpful.
I will do that.
Thank you. And as a reminder to our audience, that's star then one if you'd like to ask a question today. We'll pause a moment to allow any further questions to queue. And we have no further questions in queue at this time. I'll return the floor back to our speakers.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day. Please feel free to reach out to any of our speakers or to me, and I will put you in contact with whoever or whatever information you need. Just let us know how we can help. Thanks for spreading the word about this really important issue, and we thank you for your time.